Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. UN Chief Antonio Guterres on Tuesday said that it's time for a diplomatic solution to be found to end Russia's invasion of Ukraine and end its unwinnable and indefensible war there. The Secretary General was speaking to journalists outside the Security Council in New York, telling them from his own outreach efforts, elements of diplomatic progress were coming into view on several key issues.
The war is going nowhere fast. For more than 2 weeks, Mariupol has been encircled by the Russian army and relentlessly bombed, shelled, and attacked. For what? Even if Mariupol falls, Ukraine cannot be conquered city by city, street by street, house by house. The only outcome to all this is more suffering, more destruction, and more horror as far as the eye can see.
Nearly a month since Russia invaded Ukraine, more than 3.5 million refugees have fled the country, UN humanitarians have said. In Poland, where 2 million Ukrainians are sheltering, the World Health Organization, WHO, said that many refugees had chronic healthcare needs, requiring urgent assistance. Here's Dr. Palomi Kuchi, WHO representative in Poland.
As you can imagine, access to healthcare in Ukraine is very restricted. And on top of that, refugees are coming from a long, difficult, dangerous journey, you know, until they arrive to the border of Poland. Children are traveling for days without the proper food, without the proper water. They are tired. They are worried.
The development comes amid reports that Russian shelling has continued to target heavily built-up areas inside Ukraine. Latest UN Health Agency data has now confirmed 62 attacks on healthcare inside Ukraine since Russian forces invaded on the 24th of February. Reflecting the global commodity price crunch made worse by Russia's invasion of Ukraine, UN humanitarians in Haiti warned that it would likely hurt vulnerable people in the highly import-dependent island nation. In an alert on Tuesday, the UN World Food Programme, WFP, warned that hunger levels in Haiti were rising unabated amid persistent political instability, growing inflation and recurrent disasters. Much of the island's wheat comes from Russia and Canada, said WFP country director Pierre Honorat.
So if the wheat flour is going up, you will see a problem. And as I say, the price has already multiplied by 5 in 2 years. So what we can only expect is that it will multiply again.
Needs remain high in the southern part of Haiti, where communities are still reeling from a devastating earthquake that hit in August 2021. In the north, heavy flooding in January hit Haitians hard, prompting WFP to scale up its response with daily food deliveries. More than 4 in 10 Haitians are food insecure, including 1.5 million who require an emergency response. In Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province, unrelenting violence and bloodshed has forced thousands to flee their homes since the start of the year, the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, said on Tuesday. It comes 1 year after attacks in the northern coastal town of Palma by suspected al-Shabaab militants who began an insurgency in 2017. UNHCR's Boris Cheshakov told journalists in Geneva that attacks by non-state armed groups between January and mid-March had displaced 24,000 people in Nangad district in the far north. They need humanitarian assistance and protection services urgently, said Mr. Cheshakov, who added that hundreds of families are reportedly still on the move.
Those fleeing violence suffered and witnessed atrocities, including killings, the decapitation and dismemberment of bodies, sexual violence, kidnappings, forced recruitment by armed groups, and torture. The threat of renewed violence means the number of people arriving in Weta continues to increase.
UNHCR is working with partners and local authorities to help the displaced. It is providing shelter materials and household items to vulnerable families, monitoring those with protection needs, and supporting authorities to manage sites hosting the displaced. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
The role of NATO in war and peace in Ukraine.
A large part of the conflict goes back to the decision of the United States, first by George W. Bush, 2008, and reaffirmed by Obama, to invite Ukraine to enter NATO. Now, no Russian leader is likely to accept that.
Noam Chomsky, on the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
On TUC Radio will follow Alex Smith's Radio EcoShock in the second hour, and we'll have also after Radio Eco Shock, we'll have the UN press secretary's presser answering questions about the war in Ukraine, which runs about 5 minutes before TUC Radio. Coming up right now is the latest Democracy Now! Headlines from today.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The nonstop Russian bombardment of Mariupol continues, reducing the port city to ashes, making the rescue and evacuation of remaining residents treacherous, if not impossible. Ukrainian authorities said earlier today they reached a deal with Russia to create 9 corridors to evacuate citizens in the regions of Donetsk, Zaporizhia, Kyiv, and Luhansk. On Tuesday, the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv accused Russia of kidnapping over 2,000 Ukrainian children from the country's separatist regions. Ukrainian forces continue to hold off Russian advances around the capital and other areas as a Pentagon official said Russia's combat power declined below 90% of its pre-invasion levels. Meanwhile, U.S. and NATO officials say Belarus could soon join Russian troops in combat. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres on Tuesday said it's time to negotiate an end to the war.
Ukraine cannot be conquered city by city, street by street, house by house. The only outcome to all this is more suffering, more destruction, and more horror as far as the eye can see. The Ukrainian people are enduring a living hell.
Ukrainian officials say a series of forest fires near the Russian-occupied Chernobyl nuclear plant are further raising fears of radiation. President Biden's traveling to Europe today, where he'll meet with NATO allies and is expected to announce new sanctions on Russia. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian President Zelensky expects to speak to Chinese leader Xi Jinping, quote, very soon. In New York, Greenpeace activists on Tuesday protested a tanker carrying Russian oil into the U.S. before a ban on new imports takes effect next month. Protesters held up signs reading, "Oil fuels war." Greenpeace says the Biden administration should invoke the Defense Production Act to build sustainable energy and achieve independence from fossil fuels. This comes as a new report finds wealthy nations must completely end oil and gas production by 2034 to give the world a 50-50 chance of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Senate hearings for Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson are continuing for a third day today. On Tuesday, Judge Jackson rejected Republican accusations that her sentences in child sex abuse cases were lenient, saying she ordered, quote, strict sentences and all of the additional restraints available in the law. Republicans also went after Judge Jackson on a number of issues that have become recent flashpoints for the right. Texas Senator Ted Cruz grilled Jackson over her views on critical race theory, while Senator Marsha Blackburn attacked transgender rights, at one point asking Jackson to define the word woman. Jackson declined to do so, asserting, quote, I'm not a biologist. Senator Lindsey Graham asked Judge Jackson to rate how religious she is.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how faithful would you say you are in terms of religion? You know, I go to church probably 3 times a year, so that speaks poorly of me. Or do you attend church regularly?
Well, Senator, I am reluctant to talk about my faith in this way just because I want to be mindful of the need for the public to have confidence in my ability to separate out my personal views.
Separately, Lindsey Graham stormed out of the hearing after he clashed with Senate Judiciary Chair Dick Durbin over the ongoing detention of Guantanamo prisoners, some of whom Jackson represented as an attorney. We'll have more on that issue and day two of Ketanji Brown Jackson's historic confirmation hearings after headlines. In coronavirus news, New York City and other parts of the Northeast have reported an uptick in cases as the Omicron subvariant BA.2 spreads. One genomics firm estimates BA.2 now represents between 50 and 70% of all U.S. cases, though many health experts say they do not expect a major surge. New York City Mayor Eric Adams announced the city's mask mandate for children under 5 will be dropped on April 4th if officials deem case numbers remain low enough. This comes as the Biden administration said this week it does not have sufficient funds to purchase a fourth vaccine dose for all U.S. residents have called for and urged lawmakers to pass a stalled $15 billion funding package. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki has tested positive for the coronavirus for the second time in 5 months. Hillary Clinton also announced she has COVID and is experiencing mild cold symptoms. Oxfam International is warning 28 million people in Eastern Africa are at risk of famine as the region remains in the throes of an unfolding full-scale catastrophe. A historic years-long drought coupled with conflict has decimated agriculture in the Horn of Africa and caused massive displacement. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has also threatened the region's wheat imports, diverted international assistance, and triggered global spikes in the cost of food, energy, and fertilizer. To see our conversation with Raj Patel on how the Ukraine war will affect war hunger, go to democracynow.org. One of Guatemala's most high-profile judges fighting against corruption has resigned and fled the country, fearing for her life. Judge Erika Aifan presided over several corruption cases involving high-level Guatemalan officials, including Guatemala's president. She'd reportedly learned from a colleague that Guatemala's Supreme Court planned to strip her of her judicial immunity, putting her at risk of being detained. She's now in exile in the United States. In Jamaica, pressure's building to remove Queen Elizabeth as head of state as Prince William and Kate Middleton toured the Caribbean this week. A coalition of Jamaican politicians, business leaders, and others wrote the royals a letter accusing the Queen of perpetuating slavery and urging the British monarchy for reparations and to apologize for the destruction caused by colonialism. The royals' visit to the capital, Kingston, Tuesday was met with protests. This is a Jamaican human rights activist.
This is an insult to us, for these young people to be here to try to persuade us to keep the status quo in place when our goal is to loosen and remove the hands, the gloved hands of the Queen from around our necks so that we can breathe.
Earlier on their Caribbean trip, Prince William and Kate were forced to cancel a visit to a cocoa farm in Belize amid protests over indigenous rights and colonialism. Back in the United States, Senator Elizabeth Warren and Congressmember Ro Khanna have introduced a bill that would block large corporations from profiting off water and water rights. The legislation, known as the Future of Water Act, was introduced Tuesday on World Water Day and comes as drought conditions triggered by the climate crisis are worsening across the U.S. and the world. Meanwhile, in El Salvador, protesters Tuesday called for the repeal of a water law passed last year that critics say allows corporations to control El Salvador's water resources. In Louisiana, at least one person is dead after a large tornado triggered by a series of severe thunderstorms in the south hit New Orleans Tuesday night. Power outages and severe damage were reported in communities also devastated by Hurricane Katrina in 2005, including the Lower Ninth Ward. On Monday, at least 20 tornadoes tore through parts of Texas and Oklahoma. In Texas, at least one person was killed. Tornado warnings were issued in Mississippi and Alabama. Workers at a Seattle Starbucks unanimously voted to unionize Tuesday. It's the first unionized shop in the coffee chain's hometown, and it's just a 10-minute drive from Starbucks Seattle headquarters. Senator Bernie Sanders recently called on returning Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz to end the company's massive union-busting campaign. In other labor news, over 500 Chevron employees in Richmond, California, are on strike after failing to agree on a contract that would provide safer working conditions, better wages and benefits. Chevron posted $15.6 billion in profits last year. And in Southern California, Disney employees staged in-person and virtual walkouts Tuesday to protest the company's response to Florida's so-called Don't Say Gay legislation, which bans discussions of sexuality and gender identity in schools. Disney CEO Bob Chapek initially refused to condemn the bill and donated to politicians who backed the anti-LGBTQ measures. This is a Disney worker.
I feel like everything that's happening right now with Disney could have really huge ripple effects, not only for the company, but also the entertainment industry as a whole. So I just came here to show solidarity and hopefully get more representation, not only in front of the camera, but behind the camera and in the upper echelons of leadership as well.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
This is not the future my mother warned me about.
Welcome to Radio Eco Shock. As the world rocks to war and economic turmoil, humans continue to pour more and more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. The International Energy Agency reported world emissions from burning fossil fuels reached a new record in 2021. Emissions increased an astounding 6%, overcoming the previous smaller reduction in 2020 due to the COVID pandemic. Any hope for survival begins when we face the truth. Despite all the blah, blah, blah and green promises, we are ratcheting up the climate crisis with the most pollution in history. And the sad news is that the burst of new carbon came mainly from increasing coal for electricity and industry. The IEA says, quote, coal accounted for over 40% of the overall growth in global CO2 emissions in 2021, reaching an all-time high of 15.3 billion tons. CO2 emissions from natural gas rebounded well above their 2019 level to 7.5 billion tons. At 10.7 billion tons, CO2 emissions from oil remained significantly below pre-pandemic levels, because of the limited recovery in global transport activity in 2021, mainly in the aviation sector, end quote. However, energy from renewables hit an all-time high, small as that is. That high mark comes despite overall losses of hydropower due to drought, mainly in the United States and Brazil. Drought? I wonder why that's becoming so common.
The world's upside down, isn't it? It's all run by complete madmen and idiots, and basically men who don't know what they're doing, and they're just stuffing their pockets.
China was the world leader in new coal use and emissions. In 2021, China experienced its single biggest demand for electricity, growing 10% in 1 year. Despite installing massive wind and solar farms, China had to fill the new demand with coal and lots of it. India did the same, without doing much on renewable energy there. Emissions are slowly dropping in the United States, down 4% in 2021. The European Union dropped 2.4%, and Japan is down about 2% from 2019 levels. So the trajectory there is slightly better, but it means those countries continue to add gigatons of new greenhouse gases every year. We are still accelerating into the climate crisis.
The government has been putting loads of money into fighting terrorism, but they don't seem to be putting any real effort or money into the one really great emergency and threat that is coming. We have a cooked world.
As a result, Earth is developing into the home of extreme wildfires. You're about to hear scientist Peter Bernath from Canada and Andrew Sullivan in Australia. But first, let's set the stage. The United States agency NOAA predicts a dry spring, heat, and continuing drought for most of the western U.S. This adds water stress to low reservoirs, hardship for natural species, and all the right conditions for another bad wildfire season in the west. Most of Texas did not green up this spring, leaving a heavy fire fuel load in the continuing drought there. Texas authorities set the fire risk to the highest level. People in the eastern United States and parts of Europe find fire hard to worry about, I know that. After a storm-laden spring with whiplash between Arctic cold and abnormal hot spells, people in the east may be glad to see a few dry days. But very large fires affect everyone, everywhere. Wildfire smoke can travel hundreds of miles, affecting people's health in cities far away. Smoke from California and Oregon was tracked in New England last year. Indonesian fires traveled across the sea to blanket other countries like Malaysia and Singapore. Globally, over 30,000 people die directly from fire smoke every year.
And so we noticed all of these unprecedented changes in the stratosphere. That is, things like hydrochloric acid going down, ozone going down, and so on. And they have been induced by smoke. And so this hasn't been seen before. So somehow a new chemistry caused by smoke particles in the stratosphere was observed by us.
But now, in a new interview, we learn extreme wildfires also damage the ozone layer high in the stratosphere. Atmospheric scientist Peter Bernath reports changes in the stratosphere never seen before after the Black Summer fires in Australia in 2019 and 2020. Smoke from extreme wildfires acts to cool the world temporarily. Could back-to-back superfire years be hiding the true warming of the world? Are we still shielded from our impacts, even as we experience record-setting heat already? So according to the new report, there will be 30% more extreme fires by 2050 because of climate change. Our second guest, Dr. Andrew Sullivan from CISRO, he outlines the latest wildfire assessment from UNEP, the United Nations Environment Program. As expected, with warming, some regions will get wetter. But global wildfires, especially the most extreme fires, will increase with every decade, they say, as we continue to pour greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Superfires are already here. They create their own weather, rapid updrafts of pyrocumulonimbus clouds, like superheated vertical winds, puncture the troposphere boundary, and they arrive in the stratosphere. In the high stratosphere, these newly understood fire particles spread around the world for a year or more. That temporarily adds a cooling against our heating trend. With greenhouse gas pollution, we change everything, all the way to the outer layers of the Earth's atmosphere, to the very borders of space. Extreme wildfires will increase as the planet warms up, the IPCC tells us. New research shows an unexpected twist. These fires are changing chemistry in the upper atmosphere. The impacts can influence global temperatures and damage the ozone shield, protecting us from harmful radiation arriving from space. Peter Bernath is the research professor at the University of Waterloo and principal investigator for the Atmospheric Chemistry Experiment, or ACE. His team uses the Canadian satellite called SciSat and ground measurements. Dr. Bernath got his PhD at MIT and has lectured at universities in Florida and Arizona. He is also an eminent scholar at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia. From Waterloo, Canada, Peter Bernath, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Glad to be here.
Your latest paper title is Wildfire Smoke Destroys Stratospheric Ozone. What was your test fire to reach that conclusion?
So we're making measurements now for many years. In fact, we have 18 years of atmospheric measurements. And so we've been looking in recent years at aerosol spectra, so sulfate aerosols and a fire spectra and volcanic eruptions, ash, and so on. And so when we looked at the fire spectra, we were able to get some unique features. And we looked at the Australian fires in 2020, and we noticed these coincident in time changes in ozone and in the composition of the stratosphere. So our mission, this SciSat or ACE, is uniquely able to measure more than 44 molecules in the atmosphere. So we're able to get a very good idea about atmospheric composition, about in particular in the stratosphere. And so we noticed all of these unprecedented changes in the stratosphere. That is, things like hydrochloric acid going down, ozone going down, and so on. And they have been induced by smoke. And so this hasn't been seen before. So somehow a new chemistry caused by smoke particles in the stratosphere was observed by us.
When I was reporting on explosions at nuclear reactors in Fukushima, Japan, in 2011, we learned radioactivity only becomes global if it reaches beyond the troposphere up to the stratosphere. Is that true of smoke particles as well?
Pretty much. Once the smoke particles get into the stratosphere, the stratospheric circulation spreads it around the globe. The smoke particles in the troposphere, there's a lot of weather and rain, and pretty well things get rained out. Although, of course, they can circulate over a long distance as well. But by and large, once they're in the stratosphere, the tropopause acts as a kind of a barrier, and things then rapidly move around the globe. So, you know, in a couple of weeks, something in the stratosphere will come and go totally around and come back to where it started from.
Peter, please tell us about pyrocumulonimbus clouds. What are they? Can we see them from the ground? And how do they compare to clouds formed, say, by nuclear, by volcanic eruptions, I mean?
So you can certainly see them from the ground. There are these spectacular fires, and in the States they were seen in California this past summer. They had a lot of pyro-CBs there. And so they're nothing more than huge fires, mega fires, and things get so hot that the air gets lofted rapidly up over a very wide area, and the vertical motion is so powerful that it punches into the stratosphere. In fact, it changes the local weather. It's so strong. And these pyro-CBs have just been recognized in the last 10 years or so and studied. So they're a relatively new phenomenon. But certainly, of course, they occurred before then. But their frequency has been increasing. They can certainly be seen from the ground. They're these spectacular pictures that you see where the whole horizon is on fire. And you can see them from airplanes, and you can see them from satellites. So they're nothing more than enormous fires. They do have analogies with volcanic eruptions in that they inject soot. Volcanic eruptions inject ash and sulfur dioxide, which ends up making aerosols in the stratosphere. But both cause aerosols to be injected into the stratosphere, and both of them cause the surface to cool by reflecting and scattering sunlight, and they cause the stratosphere to warm because they absorb radiation in the stratosphere, and so they heat the stratosphere slightly. So there are analogies between the two.
You describe in the paper the high-level smoke particles as acidic hydrated soot. What does your new paper tell us about them?
Well, they've never actually been studied by spectroscopy before, so we're really the first group to take spectra of smoke particles in the stratosphere. And it's from the spectrum of these smoke particles that we see water features on the surface of the particles, and we see features associated with carboxylic acids. So we have some indication that these surfaces must be acidic and be hydrated. And these really are the first results for these stratospheric smoke particles that show that. And it seems to be universal. So we have spectra of particles recorded in the northeast United States and Canada from those fires from a few years ago, and they look very similar. So there's some characteristic stratospheric smoke that we've been able to identify.
Did the Australian bushfires of 2019 and 20 affect the size of the ozone hole over Antarctica?
No, there's no connection. It turns out that the effect that we saw was at mid latitudes in the southern hemisphere, and it never made it to the Antarctic. And in fact, the Antarctic ozone hole that year seems to be unaffected by these fires. Although some of the aerosol particles seem to have gotten down there, but it doesn't seem to have had a big effect on the Antarctic ozone hole.
And you also found wildfire smoke affected levels of nitrogen dioxide in the atmosphere. Is that the same as the warming gas nitrous oxide? And if so, how does wildfire smoke affect that particular warming gas? Do you know?
Yeah. So nitrous oxide, or laughing gas, is formed on the surface of the Earth from microorganisms, from nitrification and denitrification. And it's inert in the troposphere. But in the stratosphere, it gets dissociated. Well, it actually reacts with oxygen atoms and makes NO, and then that gets oxidized to nitrogen dioxide. So the nitrous oxide, the N2O, is the source for the NO2 in the stratosphere. And in fact, it is one of the major if you like, natural depleters of ozone. So NO2 reacts with ozone, or NO from NO2 reacts with ozone and causes ozone declines in the stratosphere. But that's a natural effect, if you like. So, you know, the N2O from the microorganisms ends up making the NO2 in the stratosphere. And the N2O is a greenhouse gas in the troposphere, but as I said, it falls apart in the stratosphere and becomes an ozone depleter, if you like, in the stratosphere.
And all these particles are going up into the air. Some of them reflect the sun back into space, and I gather that the short-term effect can be global cooling. Is that correct?
That's correct. So both volcanic eruptions and the fires cool the surface of the Earth. Interestingly, they also warm the stratosphere slightly because, you know, the soot is black, and so it absorbs sunlight. And so in addition to absorbing and scattering the sunlight and cooling the surface, it slightly warms the stratosphere.
Peter Bernath, your research finds the major concern about wildfire changes to the stratosphere is damage to the protective ozone shield. Could you explain the importance of that and in layman's terms how that happens?
Yes, it's quite straightforward because the radiation in the UV is damaging to humans and causes skin cancer. And normally the ozone in the stratosphere blocks that part of the UV radiation. And so if the ozone disappears or declines, more UV radiation gets to the ground, causes more skin cancer, and damages people's health, basically. And so the ozone layer really makes life possible on Earth. Life as we know it can't exist on Earth without the ozone layer. So anything that damages the ozone layer is not good for us, not just humans, but all organisms.
And the Montreal Protocol was aimed at healing holes in the atmospheric ozone, and the hope of the protocol was to restore the ozone layer by the middle of this century. Does your work suggest this could be more difficult or even impossible because extreme fires will continue to damage the ozone?
Well, I don't think it makes it impossible, but it certainly doesn't help. So, you know, predicting the future is always a difficult business, and we're not in that game. But certainly this decreases the amount of ozone, and that doesn't help in the recovery of the ozone layer. But the fires themselves, I should point out, the smoke, it's a transient effect. So it lasted for about a year from the Australian fire. So by the end of 2020, the ozone had recovered back to its previous value. And so it's not a permanent effect. And so in that sense, it's not as damaging as the CFCs that the Montreal Protocol is successfully controlling, by the way.
That was illuminating. I appreciate it. You know, one question I didn't ask you that I am interested in is whether the carbon that's released from wildfires is likely to cause some short-term warming. In the sense that how far does it go up into the atmosphere? How long does it stay up there? And is it going to be an impact?
Yeah, well, I can tell you what happens to the carbon.
Okay.
It gets oxidized by OH to make CO2. So it ends up being CO2. A little bit settles back down through the tropopause and ends back on the ground in that form. But it really gets oxidized. So this carboxylic acid that I was talking about, that's, I think, a step in the oxidation of the soot in the stratosphere, because things last a long time in the stratosphere. And so in the end, the carbon gets oxidized and doesn't disappear. It just transforms into carbon dioxide.
So when we talk about global warming, are we talking about something that is happening in the troposphere or something that is happening in the stratosphere?
Well, interestingly, global warming is really on the surface because the temperature of the surface is going up. You know, that's what people care about. However, in the rest of the atmosphere, in particular the upper atmosphere, a little higher in the stratosphere, mesosphere, and definitely in the thermosphere, so the signature of global warming, if you like, is it gets hotter on the surface and colder higher up. And the reason for that is pretty simple. The main gas is carbon dioxide, and once it gets up high, the atmosphere essentially becomes sort of optically thin, and so the radiation from CO2 that's emitted just goes out to space. And there's more CO2, so therefore more radiation escapes to space and the upper atmosphere actually cools. And that's a surprise to some people, but that's sort of radiative transfer. But the CO2 on the ground, that's the greenhouse effect, where the CO2 absorbs the radiation and then thermally emits it, and most of that gets blocked because it's optically thick, and it ends up being reflected back on the ground. So like a greenhouse glass pane, the radiation gets trapped in the surface by the CO2. But up high, the CO2, the radiative transfer, the CO2 becomes optically thin. That is, the radiation can escape freely. And so more CO2, more radiation escapes, and the upper atmosphere cools.
So this satellite called SciSat, it was launched in 2003. The expected life was 2 to 5 years. Is it still operating, and is there a plan to replace it if needed?
It's certainly still operating. It's producing data almost as good as ever. Indeed, because of the long time series, it's more valuable than ever because it's monitoring the change in composition of the atmosphere. And of course, as you know, that's what's driving climate change is the changes. And we see that and we measure that. And we measure all the Montreal Protocol gases, almost all of them. And so we see that the Montreal Protocol is working, for example. And with respect to replacing the satellite, there's always talk about it, but no action.
Peter, your work's not just earthbound. You also study molecular astronomy. What is that, and what are scientists trying to find out?
Well, essentially, except for our own solar system, you can't actually sample things outside our solar system. And so if you want to study the composition of stars and now exoplanets, you have to do it by spectroscopy, the same kind of remote sensing that we're using with SciSat. And the astronomers need some help from laboratory spectroscopy to understand what they're looking at. And so we have NASA funding, for example, to look at molecules that are found in hot exoplanets. So exoplanets are planets around other stars, rather than in our own sun. And so we make laboratory measurements and analyze the data to predict and help the astronomers model what they see in exoplanets. And there's now thousands of exoplanets. They're typically hot, and those are the ones that we're providing data for. But, of course, the long-term goal is to find cooler Earth-like exoplanets and get the composition of their atmosphere. And, again, that's all done by spectroscopy, the same kind of measurements that we're making in the Earth's atmosphere.
I see a lot of this coming out of Einstein's work on what light really is.
Indeed.
From the University of Waterloo and the Atmospheric Chemistry Experiment Lab, we've been speaking with Professor Peter Bernath. You can find links to the new science we just talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Peter, thank you for sharing your time with us.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
From the 1958 Frank Capra film Unchained Goddess.
Extremely dangerous questions, because with our present knowledge, we have no idea what would happen. Even now, man may be unwittingly changing the world's climate through the waste products of his civilization. Due to our release through factories and automobiles every year of more than 6 billion tons of carbon dioxide, which helps air absorb heat from the sun, our atmosphere seems to be getting warmer.
This is bad.
Well, it's been calculated a few degrees rise in the Earth's temperature would melt the polar ice caps. And if this happens, an inland sea would fill a good portion of the Mississippi Valley. Tourists in glass-bottomed boats would be viewing the drowned towers of Miami through 150 feet of tropical water. For in weather, we're not only dealing with forces of a far greater variety than even the atomic physicist encounters, but with life itself.
Wildfires far beyond normal are coming. The latest summary of fire science comes in a new report from the UN Environmental Program. and the Norwegian nonprofit called Grid Arenda. Australians already live the new fiery future. That is where we reached one of the principal authors of this report, one of the leading wildfire experts in the world, Dr. Andrew Sullivan. He leads the Bushfire Behavior and Risks Team at CSIRO, the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization. From Canberra, Australia, Andrew Sullivan, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, Eric, how's it doing?
Well, it's tough times around the world, so it's hard to say good, but we have some important news here, I think, from the UNEP report. And I want to go back a year. The casualties and the damages in the Australian summer of 2019-2020, they are still stunning. Thousands of buildings burned, hundreds of people dead, some from smoke, perhaps a billion animals killed. How does that major fire season work into this new report from the United Nations?
Well, it's a good example of the scale of wildfire events that we're likely to see more of by the end of the century.
You know, an unusual forest fire just missed an operating nuclear reactor in South Korea. The Florida Panhandle is burning. The Copernicus Satellite Service reports record high fire intensity in South America in the first 3 months of this year. Is this normal, Andrew? Or when it comes to wildfires, should we expect normal anymore?
That's a good question. And in many instances, there probably isn't such a thing as normal. There's average, and that average, I think we can safely say, is changing. The expectation of the frequency of wildfires and their severity is expected to increase under climate change. And by the end of this century, you're expecting the frequency of such fires, such devastating fires, to increase by about 30 to 50% over the current experience.
But there are some surprises in the report. For example, we can't simply say everywhere we'll see more wildfires, can we?
No, that's right. The 30 to 50% is the global average. So some instances will see significant increases in the occurrence of wildfires. Other places may see a decrease in the occurrence of wildfires. So it's like wildfires themselves, they're rather complex beasts, and the impact that we expect of wildfires is likely to be very complex. So we can't simply say that everywhere is going to experience more fires. The variability in the climate and the variability in the impact of the climate on vegetation means that the result on wildfires is going to be highly variable as well around the globe.
Well, some regions actually get wetter as the climate shifts. You would think that protects them from wildfires, but is that necessarily true?
Not necessarily true. Because of the variability that we see in the climate, we will have wetter periods, which can encourage more growth, but there's also likely to be drier periods that follow. So it's possible that those areas that see an average increase in rainfall can still experience dry periods in which that extra growth that occurred during the wetter period is now available as fuel. So it's one of these very, very complex dynamics that wildfires sort of are a result of in terms of the impact of the climate on the vegetation and the impact of the climate on the fire conditions as well. It is not a very simple dynamic to try to understand.
But it's true, large fires have burned here on Earth for eons. Are we really seeing anything new?
It's one of the difficult components that we had in preparing the report was we understand that fire in the landscape is a very common event in the world. And for the most part, the vast majority of those fires that burn freely in the landscape do not cause a concern. They may be accidental, they may be a result of natural ignition such as dry lightning, or they may be intentional. But more than 90% of the fires that occur annually around the globe aren't what we would necessarily call a wildfire because they may be uncontrolled, but they're not necessarily causing a concern for social, economic, or ecological reasons. So we wouldn't define them for the purposes of our report as a wildfire. What we defined as wildfires are those free-burning fires in the landscape that do cause a concern, either for social impacts, either they're affecting lives and livelihoods, or they're affecting infrastructure, or they may be an environmental impact. That's what we defined as wildfire, and it's a very small percentage of the total number of fires that occur across the globe during the year.
Yeah, you know, I'd almost like to add climate change in there. I know there's some debate. I mean, the vegetation grows back. It reabsorbs the carbon that's emitted in the fires, we're told. But sometimes the vegetation is not growing back properly for various reasons. So if you have a giant fire that doesn't affect humans, but let's say it's up in the boreal and it's roaring, might that not change the carbon balance even on the short term?
Oh, very definitely. There are lots of examples of fires that, for the most part, nobody would actually call them a concern because they're not spreading very fast and they don't produce flames very high. And in particular, I'm talking here about peat fires, either in the Arctic or tropical locations. Those fires spread at centimetres an hour. They're very small, but there's nobody around to do anything about them, and they can burn for months and months and months, and they can release a huge amount of carbon that would normally have been stored in the organic layers of the soil. Those are the fires that we also want to call wildfires because they do very much cause an environmental concern. And we've seen lots of examples in the past where peat fires, particularly in tropical Southeast Asia, have released huge amounts of particulates into the air and created enormous health issues for populations that are impacted by the smoke that's released by that. So I would agree that there are some fires that, while not a direct impact on humans as such in terms of their lives and livelihoods, but they do have impacts either ecologically or in terms of long-term health for many people who are a long, long way from where the fire actually occurs.
When your team looks at the global map for increasing wildfire danger, what are the hot spots, so to speak, where populations and governments may have to try to adapt to a new fire regime?
There are lots of very specific locations around the world where the modelling that was done in the UK suggested that the threat of wildfires in the future is going to increase significantly. What came out of that analysis was there are some regions that you would not have previously thought were a danger in terms of wildfire. One of these was the Middle East. Another was India, so the subcontinent, and northern Russia, Siberia. So places like that would not have traditionally been thought to have been a wildfire hotspot, say, not like what you'd call Australia or Canada or the US, but they are increasingly being affected by wildfires, and they're happening in those places that don't have a history of dealing with wildfires. So they've got a major hurdle to overcome, not just the impact of the fire itself, but what to do about it. They don't have a history of managing wildfires. So the important thing that came out of the report is that many of these areas that are newly being affected by wildfires can learn a lot from what's been occurring elsewhere in the world. They can also teach other places that have been affected by wildfires. So the true message that comes out of the report is that there are lessons to be learnt by everybody everywhere. There is no single jurisdiction in the world that solved the problem of wildfires. So the important bit is we need to learn about wildfires and learn to live with wildfires, basically, undertake the steps necessary to reduce the risks as much as possible, but also realise that you cannot reduce that risk to zero. You need to be able to deal with the residual risk of wildfires when they do occur.
Well, trying to understand what fires do, Andrew Sullivan, you developed a kind of fire test tunnel, the Pyrotron. What does that tell us?
So the Pyrotron is a combustion wind tunnel that allows us to study the behaviour of fires burning through bushfire fuels, what we call bushfire fuel. So this is just natural vegetation that we place inside the tunnel, and we can study the mechanisms and processes by which these flames propagate through that natural fuel to get a better understanding of the factors that influence the behaviour of fires and develop better understanding of what steps could be done to try to reduce the impact of those fires.
Firefighters need to know how fast fires will spread. In fact, we all need to know that in order to guide evacuations. How well can experts predict fire speed these days?
Well, I would say we can predict the speed of fires in most vegetation types pretty well. Various places around the world have different ways of doing that. In Australia, we've got what we call fuel-specific fire spread models. So we've got fire spread models for specific fuel types. So we have a grassland fire spread model or a forest fire spread model. And those models, given the nature of fire behaviour and the variability both in terms of the inputs that go into determining a fire and the vagaries of fire combustion itself, we've found that we can predict pretty well, and the measure of pretty well is in the order of about plus or minus 35% of the actual speed. Some of the models do far better than that, and there are some models that struggle, but it's primarily because we don't actually know the conditions in which the fire is burning. So the uncertainties that are involved in the inputs, and the inputs are quite complex, it's the nature of the fuel and it's the weather that's driving it, and the specific locations about where that fire actually is. So all of those uncertainties mean that the predictions have some uncertain bounds on them, but the nature of the fire is pretty well understood, and I think we've been able to predict fairly well the rate of propagation of wildfires and the direction of propagation of wildfires.
Even though there have been some terrible fires and a lot of video on the news, people do continue to move into the forest interface zone and suburbs spring up among the trees. Isn't the fire situation a little like coastal flooding? Death and damage is worse because we move into the danger zone.
It's certainly one of the factors that's increasing fire risk globally, and more generally we would describe that as land use change. So that's both in terms of people moving into areas that were predominantly, you know, at risk from fire, but it's also people moving away from rural areas. So fires that do occur are now getting bigger because there's nobody there to do anything about them. So that dynamic of the change in populations and the use of land is one of the big factors, along with climate change, as to why our fire risk is changing so rapidly and expected to change so significantly by the end of the century.
Speaking of flooding, Eastern Australia just went through incredible floods. Here in BC, we had torrential rains and never before seen landslides and floods, along with a big heat dome and the fires. Are there connections between floods and fires?
No, that's not my area of expertise, but it is one of the other sides of the coin, if you will. So the conditions for widespread conflagration fire is extended rainfall deficit, what we call drought, basically. That preconditions the fuel for ignition and makes it difficult for fires to be put out. The flip side of rainfall deficit is increase in the rainfall. And Australia particularly has a long history of a cycle of drought and flooding rains. And there's a very famous poem by Dorothea McCullough called My Country that has that line, a land of drought and flooding rains. We have the extremes of those almost continually. You started off about the word average, and I think that's a good angle to take, in that we have droughts and we have flooding rains. The average is something in the middle that is nice, but we don't actually spend a lot of time at the average. We spend a lot of time at either of the extremes. And it's one of those things that in Australia, particularly with the experience I've had, that we will have major fire events like we had in 2019, 2020, and very soon after there will be a change. And quite often this has been attributed to events like El Nino and La Nina, where we go from the extensive rainfall deficit and droughts across much of the country that can last anywhere between 5-10 years, and then we'll flip into the flooding rains bit, where we will have repeated weather cycles that mean that we have low pressure systems that dump lots and lots of rain over the East Coast. And I'm sure that sort of experience is common in other parts of the world as well.
From another of your past papers, I learned a key thing, I think. When a bushfire is over, it is far from over. Talk to us about the health impacts and ecological damage that continues long after the flames subside.
Yeah, the interesting thing about fires, in contrast to flood, is that the sphere of influence of a fire is much, much larger than the actual fire itself. So an average fire might burn, not the average fire, but a significant fire might burn 100,000 hectares, say. But the sphere of influence of the effect of that fire could be 10, 100 times that area in terms of people impacted by the smoke that fire generated, the damage that fire has done on the infrastructure that then affects larger populations. The scaling up of the impact of a fire is quite significant in some places. So even a small fire can have a huge impact depending on where it is and what it burns. floods generally only affect the area where the flood is. It's not one of those phenomena that has a huge knock-on effect. One of the key things that came out of the UNEP report that we recently published was the health costs associated with wildfires, particularly extensive wildfires, is runs up into the billions, where you're getting lots of people who don't even get to see the flames that are significantly affected by the smoke, with cardiovascular issues. And as an example, the 2019-20 fire season in Australia had, I think it was like 33 fatalities in direct result of the fires, but the fatalities afterwards as a result of the health impacts from the smoke that was released, it was in the order of 450 to 500 people. And so the cost associated with the second order health impacts of fires is quite significant. And when you consider places like Indonesia, when they have a delay in the wet season arriving and the peat fires take hold, it can release huge amounts of particulate matter into the atmosphere that can affect really large areas. And those areas happen to have really high populations. So you can imagine that the health impacts of those sorts of events can be quite significant. The cost is monumental.
Yes, the Indonesian fires went all the way to Singapore and Malaysia, as I recall. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking about the new report, The Rising Threat of Extraordinary Landscape Fires. Our guest is one of the premier wildfire experts, Dr. Andrew Sullivan from CISRO in Australia. So according to the new report, there will be 30% more extreme fires by 2050 because of climate change. Andrew, is it possible for governments to prepare for that?
It's something that they need to prepare for, I think. The first step is understanding what the problem is and how to address it. Now, there's a significant amount of work that's gone into trying to understand the factors that drive the behaviour and occurrence of wildfires. The analysis that was presented in that report is based on more than just climate changes. There's elements in there of the land use change. As I said, there's another factor that influences the risk profile of wildfires. But the important bit is that steps can be done to reduce the propensity for wildfires breaking out and increase the effectiveness of mitigation steps to try to reduce their impact. So that includes things like ignition control measures and fuel management to reduce the intensity of fires, and as well as suppression of fires when they do break out.
When fires strike in developed countries, places like California, people may be helped by insurance or government aid, and some manage to rebuild. But what is the situation in less developed regions where people contribute so little to global warming gases?
It's a major risk in developing countries, and fires have been identified as a major problem in those developing countries to try to reach the development goals. The impact of fire on social, economic and environmental values in developing countries can have a much longer lasting effect than they would in developed countries. But that being said, the impacts in developed countries can also be quite significant. And as I said earlier, there's no one country in the world that solved the problem. And the solution to those problems isn't a technological solution in and of itself. It needs to be part of a suite of approaches to address the fire problem at all the different intersections in the process. And so that's about communities understanding what their fire risk is, understanding the necessity for steps to be put in place to mitigate fire risk, understanding what the cost of those mitigation steps are, and understanding that there will be a residual risk of fire that they need to be able to deal with. And so that goes everything from the individual householder right up to government. There's a continuous chain of responsibility required to be able to address the increasing threat of wildfires around the world.
In 2013, I interviewed British Columbia silviculturalist John Betts, and John stressed the need to control forest fuels before the superfires develop rather than spending the money after to put them out. And I see this in the UNEP report. Are we misspending some of our money for fire protection?
So that's a question to be asked of each individual government. Generally speaking, there is a propensity to wait until the fire starts before money is spent, and that money is generally spent on suppression of that fire. And for the most part, the effort put into suppression when wildfires are burning at their extreme is not going to have much an effect on the behaviour of that fire until the weather starts to moderate. But you can do a lot more before that fire breaks out to manage the fuels and reduce the hazard that is presented by those fuels, such that if a fire was to break out, it'd have a lower probability of being a successful outbreak, and you would increase the effectiveness of the suppression that you did undertake to try to stop that fire when it did start. So there is definitely across the world an imbalance in where investment is. And the recommendation coming out of the report is that there needs to be more money spent in that earlier phase of planning and preparation and reduction of risk before wildfires break out to reduce the impact of those fires. And the impact of those fires is hundreds of orders of magnitude greater than the costs that are spent on managing fires.
This is a big report from the UN, and it's a good summary of the best fire science that we know so far. Does it also look at the impacts on wild animals and plants?
There is a section in the report that looks at that. So the report, as you say, is quite significant. There's more than 50 authors from around the world, more than 37 organisations, and almost 30 countries contributed to that report. And we use case studies from various parts of the world to look at the various impacts that fires have and various steps that different countries have taken to try to address that. One of the case studies looks at the impact of fires on animals and flora and fauna. The complexity that is involved in that, as explained earlier, there's lots of complexity, is that there are many ecosystems around the world that actually require fire to be healthy. So it's not just a matter of excluding fire. The fire needs to be there, but what we need to do is control the sorts of fires that do occur such that ecosystems can continue to function healthily, but they don't have deleterious impacts. And associated with those ecosystems is the fauna involved. As we saw with the 2019-20 fire season in Australia, the sheer extent of those fires meant that many animals had no refuge from the heat of the flames. And the fatalities involved in the animals was quite horrendous in magnitude. So what we need to be able to do is manage the risk of those fires in such a way that animals have refuge and paths of egress out of the path of any fire that does occur to ensure that they've got a way to survive the fire event. And that is very specific to each ecosystem around the world.
And what are you working on now? Just tell us that as we wrap this up.
Well, we've just completed construction of a new lab that houses the Pyrotron that you mentioned earlier, and we're actually next week having a virtual opening of the facility, which is a big focus for me at the moment. But more generally, we're focusing on improving our understanding of various aspects of fire behaviour and refining the fire spread models that we've developed and that are used operationally for predicting the spread of fire across the landscape.
From CISRO in Australia, we've been speaking with wildfire expert Dr. Andrew Sullivan. You can find links to read the new UNEP report, Wildfire, The Rising Threat of Extraordinary Landscape Fires, in my show blog at ecoshock.org and, of course, at unep.org. Andrew, thank you for sharing your valuable time with us.
Thanks, Alex. It's my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
In case you doubt that we are in a new time of fire, a study in Science Advances is titled U.S. Fires Become Larger, More Frequent, and More Widespread in the 2000s. It was led by Virginia Iglesias. The authors say, quote, "We found compelling evidence that average fire events in regions in the United States are up to four times the size, triple the frequency, and more widespread in the 2000s than in the previous two decades. Moreover, the most extreme fires are also larger, more common, and more likely to co-occur with other extreme fires. This documented shift in burning patterns across most of the country aligns with the palpable change in fire dynamics noted by the media, public, and firefighting officials, end quote. Find a link to that report in my show blog at ecoshock.org, published on Wednesdays. We now see climate change in action. There are so many hot spots and emergencies in living systems. The Arctic is abnormally warm in March 2022. The Svalbard measuring station north of Norway was from 3.9 degrees C to 5.5 degrees C hotter than normal. An early melt is happening. The Arctic sea ice is currently at its fourth lowest state on record. Antarctic sea ice is also very low.
Oh my God, breaking up!
Antarctica. The Washington Post reported March 18th. It's 70 degrees warmer than normal in eastern Antarctica. Scientists are flabbergasted. Jason Salmonow and Dasha Patel write, Antarctic climatology has been rewritten, tweeted Stefano Di Battista, a researcher who has published studies on Antarctic temperatures. He added that such temperature anomalies would have been considered impossible and unthinkable before they actually occurred. End quote from the Post. Three cautions. One, that 70 degrees is Fahrenheit, being around 40 degrees Celsius. Two, that does not mean Antarctica is suddenly melting. For example, temperatures at the High Concordia Research Station would normally be around minus 50 degrees C, but they rose for about 3 days to minus 12 degrees C, still below freezing. Third, the warmth comes from a wet atmospheric river, which may actually add snow to the interior of Antarctica. That could be a good thing because it helps delay melting and may cool Earth a little bit longer. Even so, temperatures in Antarctica rose beyond anything experienced before. Nothing in scientific models showed this as possible. The record-shattering heat in Antarctica again demonstrates we are moving into a new climate beyond human experience and beyond our prediction and imagination. Expect the unexpected. Australian coral experts are investigating yet another major die-off in the Great Barrier Reef, the nursery of the sea. Planes are out measuring to find the extent of what could be the sixth major coral bleaching event, most in the last 10 years. We're watching a life source flickering out because of hot oceans, because of our emissions.
It's a sense of loss. You know, I mean, your future is very uncertain. You know that you're up against one of the most powerful industries in the world. And the industry and the state and federal governments, they're just looking for the money. Mm. And unfortunately, the human cost is not on their agenda.
In the new carbon-charged world, you are listening to Radio EcoShock, broadcast around the world on radio and the Internet. Find Radio EcoShock on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, the weekly show blog, ecoshock.org. Tune in. Turn on. Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith makes YouTube videos explaining the latest science and reports on climate change. His specialty is the Arctic, but Paul surveys science all over the world. In mid-March, he caught up with a report from the British institution called Chatham House. You may have heard of Chatham House rules. People meet in groups, but they're never named. They have an organization with staff. Four of their staff released a report in September 2021 called Climate Change Risks 2021. Their subhead says, the risks are compounding, and without immediate action, the impacts will be devastating, end quote. I'm going to read you some of the highlight quotes from that report. Here we go. Any relapse or stasis in emissions reduction policies could lead to a plausible worst case of 7 degrees C of warming by the end of the century, 10% chance, says Chatham House report. Unless NDCs, the nationally determined contributions under the Paris Accord, are dramatically increased and policy and delivery mechanisms are revised, many of the impacts described in this research paper are likely to be locked in by 2040 and become so severe they go beyond the limits of what nations can adapt to. If emissions do not come down drastically before 2030, then by 2040, Some 3.9 billion people are likely to experience major heat waves, 12 times more than the historic average. By the 2030s, 400 million people globally each year are likely to be exposed to temperatures exceeding the workability threshold. Also by the 2030s, the number of people on the planet exposed to heat stress exceeding the survivability threshold is likely to surpass 10 million a year. To meet global demand, agriculture will need to produce almost 50% more food by 2050. However, yields could decline by 30% in the absence of dramatic emissions reductions. By 2040, the average proportion of global cropland affected by severe drought will likely rise to 32% a year, more than three times the historic average. That is from the Chatham House report called Climate Change Risks 2021. I will put a link in my blog at ecoshock.org. Last week, the world lost a great campaigner. I first met Lafcadio Cortizzi when he was a forest campaigner for Greenpeace International in the early 1990s. He was born an American, a fan of the Grateful Dead. Lafcadio moved with his young family to Indonesia. He adopted Indonesian dress and learned to speak the language of Bahasa. Lafcadio loved the jungles, jungle creatures, from Sumatra through Borneo to Papua New Guinea. Cortizzi worked tirelessly to save those forests for Rainforest Action Network, Forest Ethics, and most recently for the Canadian-based organization Canopy. He was an irrepressible force. Lafcadio loved to laugh, to dance, to infect people with joy. Everyone knew when Lafcadio was not just in the room, but in the building. Without any signs of illness, in his late 50s, Lafcadio went to bed and passed in his sleep. It is a complete shock to his family, his workmates, and everyone who knew him. There is a Facebook page in memory of Lafcadio Cortizzi. It rapidly filled up with photos and memories from environmentalists all over the world, many inspired by him. Rest in peace, friend. At this time, the war in Ukraine continues its pitiless pace of destruction, both of lives and property. While North Americans pull off the masks and party, it's the end of the pandemic. But a new wave is just beginning in China. South Korea, so admired for its control of the virus in 2020, just reported over 600,000 new cases in a single day. Virus death rates in Hong Kong are the highest in the world. This is mostly the super transmitter variation called BA2. It can reinfect people who had previous versions of COVID. Fortunately, we know a new virus in China could never spread to the rest of the world. Oh, wait. There are no special controls on planes coming in from Asia. Most countries have dropped testing requirements for entry. Global trade continues. The virus is increasing and increasing in Europe and especially in Great Britain. Of course another wave will come. There are millions of people still unvaccinated, and all vaccine protection is beginning to wane. Seniors need a fourth shot. We are letting our guard down, even as the enemy approaches. As you heard in this program, and almost every week on Radio EcoShock, the grand long-term threat and immediate source of more crisis is climate change. Through war, economic troubles, starvation, or plagues, we just keep burning fossil fuels and tearing down nature. We could still put out the fossil fire before it consumes our only home. Let's do that. Stop exploring for more oil and gas. Stop your governments allowing that. Stop financing coal and close that industry down. Slash your own energy use and expectations. Demand action from governments at every level, including the local. Join and support climate action groups. Show your strength. And most of all, believe that we can. I'm Alex Smith. A real thank you for listening and caring about this world.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
World Violinists for Ukraine.
One month ago, the Russian Federation launched a massive invasion of the sovereign territory of Ukraine in violation of the UN Charter. It was done after months of building up a military force of overwhelming proportion along the Ukrainian border. Since then, we have seen appalling human suffering and destruction in cities, towns, and villages. Systematic bombardments that terrorize civilians, the shelling of hospitals, schools, apartment buildings, and shelters. And all of it is intensifying, getting more destructive and more unpredictable by the hour. 10 million Ukrainians have been forced from their homes and are on the move. But the war is going nowhere fast. For more than 2 weeks, Mariupol has been encircled by the Russian army and relentlessly bombed, shelled, and attacked. For what? Even if Mariupol falls, Ukraine cannot be conquered city by city, street by street, house by house. The only outcome to all this is more suffering, more destruction, and more horror as far as the eye can see. The Ukrainian people are enduring a living hell, and the reverberations are being felt worldwide with skyrocketing food, energy and fertilizer prices threatening to spiral into a global hunger crisis. Developing countries were already suffocating under the burden of COVID and the lack of access to adequate financing. Now they are also paying a heavy price as a result of this war. At the same time, we cannot lose hope. From my outreach with various actors, elements of diplomatic progress are coming into view on several key issues. There is enough on the table to cease hostilities now and seriously negotiate now. This war is unwinnable. Sooner or later it will have to move from the battlefield to the peace table. And that is inevitable. The only question is how many more lives must be lost. How many more bombs must fall? How many Mariupols must be destroyed? How many more Ukrainians and Russians will be killed before everyone realizes that this war has no winners, only losers? How many more people will have to die in Ukraine? And how many people around the world will have to face hunger for this to stop? Continuing the war in Ukraine is morally unacceptable, politically indefensible, and militarily nonsensical. What I said from this podium almost 1 month ago should be even more evident today. By any measure, by even the shrewdest calculation, it is time to stop the fighting now and give peace a chance. It is time to end this absurd war. Thank you.
Thank you. TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Neutrality or Membership, the Role of NATO in War and Peace in Ukraine. Professors Noam Chomsky and John Mersheimer. On January 10, 2022, the author, linguist, and historian Noam Chomsky addressed the question, was Ukraine invited to become part of NATO, and who did the inviting?
A large part of the conflict goes back to the decision of the United States, first by George W. Bush, 2008, and reaffirmed by Obama, to invite Ukraine to enter NATO. Now, no Russian leader is likely to accept that. Ukraine has far too great geostrategic significance and also historical significance and cultural significance to Russia for Russian leaders, Putin or anyone else, to accept incorporation of Ukraine within a hostile military alliance. Now, this effort by the United States was vetoed by France and Germany, but that didn't mean anything. The United States proceeds with it. Of course, that would mean withdrawal of the U.S. call for Ukraine to join NATO. It would mean that Ukraine would have sort of Austrian-style neutrality, the kind that Austria had right through the Cold War, not part of any military alliance. It would mean that there'd be some kind of federation in Ukraine, which would provide degree of autonomy to the Donbass region, demilitarization, a couple of other conditions. All of this is quite feasible. It's not what's happening. The United States, under strong internal pressure from right-wing and also centrist opinion, is moving towards intensifying the crisis. So is Putin. This is the most dangerous crisis in the world right now, and also the most easily settled. Now, this goes back to the question of the means by which NATO was expanded. You go back to the collapse of the Soviet Union. There were several conceptions of how the Eurasia region should be organized. One of them, which was advanced by Mikhail Gorbachev and by Germany, Hans Dietrich Genscher, the German foreign minister, both of them proposed a kind of a Eurasian security system with no military blocs. Well, that was rejected by the United States. It was actually supported by Germany. A core part of this was unification of Germany, which the Germans, of course, wanted. And the question was how this could take place. I remember, for Russia, unification of Germany is not a trivial matter. Germany alone had virtually destroyed Russia several times during the past century. So for Russia to agree, as Gorbachev did, to agree to allowing Germany to be unified within NATO, hostile military alliance, was quite a concession. But there was a condition. Condition was that NATO would not expand to the east. The phrase that was used was not one inch to the east. That meant East Germany. Nobody was contemplating broader expansion, at least in public, maybe privately they were. NATO did advance to East Germany under Bush, and under Clinton, it moved all the way to the Russian border, Baltic states, other states, Balkan states. It could have been done in a way which would have eliminated, certainly eased tensions. There was what was called the Partnership for Peace in the 1990s, which was a pretty sensible approach that contemplated expanding NATO or another general alliance to to include the East European states, but to do it in stages, varying from country to country, depending on the circumstances, taking Russian concerns into consideration, even contemplating bringing Russia itself into this system, as incidentally Putin has suggested. These were all possibilities. They were abandoned in favor of what was called the Clinton Doctrine. Let's just expand militarily right to the border of Russia, militarizing, bringing them into NATO, weapon systems that are called defensive, but of course threaten Russia. All of this was done in a manner which was almost guaranteed to increase tensions. We're now facing it. And what's happening is extremely dangerous, but also has a solution, one in which Europe would play a central role. But that, of course, requires that Europe take up the option, which has already always had, to become an independent force in world affairs. Has that option? It's rejected it. It's chosen to be subordinate to the United States. And as long as Europe does that, we'll be in serious danger.
That was Noam Chomsky on the risk of Europe being subordinate to U.S. NATO politics. This was an excerpt from his January 10, 2022 presentation on the podcast Europe Matters. After a lifetime teaching at MIT, Chomsky is now Laureate Professor of Linguistics at the University of Arizona, and still active as philosopher, historian, and author. On March 3, 2022, Professor John Mersheimer spoke on the topic of Putin's invasion of Ukraine. NATO membership versus neutrality has become the most contested factor in the attempts to bring peace to Ukraine. However, the history of the founding and subsequent expansion of NATO is redacted or unknown. John Mersheimer is professor of political science at the University of Chicago. He has taught there since 1982. He has written extensively about security issues and international politics. He begins by asking, who caused the current crisis?
I'd like to break my talk into two parts. I'd like to first of all talk about the causes of the present crisis, and I'd like to speculate on where this is all headed. It's very important to understand that who caused this situation is of tremendous importance because it involves assigning blame. You really have two choices here. You can argue that the West, and especially the United States, caused the crisis, or you can argue that the Russians caused the crisis. But that means that whoever you argue caused the crisis is responsible for this disaster. And it is important to understand that this is a disaster. Ukraine has lost Crimea. It's, in my opinion, going to lose the Donbass. And the only interesting question to me at this point is whether it's also going to lose more territory in the eastern part of its country. Furthermore, Ukraine's economy is wrecked. Its cities are in the process of being wrecked. The international economy is going to be badly affected by these events as they go on. This is going to have terrible consequences, I think, for the Democrats in the fall. Furthermore, it makes it difficult for the United States to pivot out of Europe and pivot to China, where there is a potential threat, which is China. Furthermore, we're driving the Russians into the arms of the Chinese, which makes no sense at all. And all at the same time, we're making Eastern Europe a very unstable region, and therefore forcing us to, if anything, up the ante there. So this is a disastrous situation. So the question of who caused it and who bears the blame really matters. Now, the conventional wisdom in the United States and in the West more generally is that the Russians are responsible for this, and in particular, Vladimir Putin is responsible. As I'm sure almost all of you know, I haven't bought this argument at all, and I haven't bought it for a long time. In my opinion, the West bears primary responsibility for what is happening today. And it was largely a result of a decision in April 2006 to make Ukraine and to make Georgia a part of NATO. We were going to integrate Ukraine into NATO come hell or high water. Now, the Russians said at the time that this is categorically unacceptable. The Russians made it clear that they had swallowed the first two tranches of NATO expansion, the 99 expansion and the 2004 expansion, but Georgia and Ukraine were not going to become part of NATO. They were drawing a line in the sand. They said this is an existential threat to us. And indeed, in August of that year, of course, August 2008, you had a war involving the Russians and the Georgians over the whole issue of whether or not Georgia would become part of NATO. Now, it's important to understand that when we talk about Western policy and we focus on NATO and expansion of NATO into Ukraine, that actually Western policy had three prongs to it. The core prong was definitely integrating Ukraine into NATO, but the other two prongs were integrating Ukraine into the European Union and turning Ukraine into a pro-Western liberal democracy, in effect, putting in place the Orange Revolution. And these three prongs of the strategy were all designed to make Ukraine a pro-Western country. Now, the first crisis broke out in February 2014. Then you had a major crisis breaking out in December of last year, that's December 2021, and on February 24th of this year, the war started. Now, what about this crisis in February of 2014, February 22nd to be exact? It was precipitated in large part by a coup that was supported by the United States that took place in Ukraine and resulted in a pro-Russian leader, President Yanukovych, being overthrown and being replaced by a pro-American prime minister. The Russians found this intolerable. At the same time, they were debating with the West and with the Ukrainians over EU expansion. And always in the background at that point in time was NATO expansion. This blew up, and it had two consequences. One is that the Russians, in effect, took Crimea away from Ukraine for themselves. The second thing happened is that the Russians helped foster a civil war in eastern Ukraine. And of course, that civil war festered well after 2014. Then, starting about mid-year, and really heating up at the end of last year, I would say in December 2021, was a second major crisis. And the question is, what caused this crisis? And in my opinion, it was caused largely by the fact that Ukraine was becoming a de facto member of NATO. It's commonplace in the West, especially in Washington these days, to say that Russia had nothing to fear regarding Ukraine becoming part of NATO. And Russia had nothing to fear because NATO was doing nothing to move forward Ukraine's incorporation into NATO. I think in a de jure sense, that's absolutely correct. But in a de facto way, that's wrong. What we were doing was we were arming the Ukrainians. And you want to remember, it's President Trump in December of 2017, who was under great pressure, who decided to arm the Ukrainians. So we were arming the Ukrainians, we were training the Ukrainians, and we were forming ever closer diplomatic ties with the Ukrainians. And this spooked the Russians. It especially spooked the Russians in the summer of last year when Ukrainian military used drones against Russian forces in the Donbass region. It especially spooked the Russians last summer when the British drove a destroyer through territorial waters, Russian territorial waters in the Black Sea. It especially spooked the Russians in November when we were flying bombers within 13 miles of the Russian coast. So all these events, coupled with this de facto bringing of Ukraine into NATO, pushed the Russians to what Sergei Lavrov said was the boiling point. You know, Lavrov was asked in January why the Russians had reached this point and why we were in the midst of a crisis. And he said, Lavrov said in January, we had reached our boiling point. First expansion of NATO, second expansion of NATO, and then all of these events associated with Ukraine. The Russians had had it. So you had a crisis of massive proportions, which of course resulted on February 24th in the Russians invading Ukraine. And we are now in the midst of a real war. This is not just a civil war in eastern Ukraine, which is what we had before February 24th. We now have a real war. So this brings us to the question of what is the conventional wisdom on this subject, and how do I think about the opposing argument? The opposing argument is that this has nothing to do with NATO expansion. It's really quite remarkable. When you listen to people in the administration speak, and when you read editorials in the Washington Post, words like this are spoken. This has absolutely nothing to do with NATO expansion. I don't know how anybody can say that. The Russians have been saying since April 2008 that this is all about NATO expansion, that NATO expansion into Ukraine is an existential threat to them. But Americans simply refuse to believe that. Not all Americans, but many Americans, and certainly the policy elite in this country. And instead, what they have done is they've created a story that it is not American policy. It's not NATO expansion that's driving this train. Instead, it's Vladimir Putin. And it's the fact that Vladimir Putin is either bent on recreating the Soviet Union or he's interested in creating a greater Russia. But whichever one of those two outcomes you take, he is ultimately an expansionist. He's on the march. And thank God we expanded NATO, because if we hadn't expanded NATO, he'd probably be in Berlin by now, if not Paris. This is the basic argument. He is an aggressor. There are a number of problems with that argument. First of all, before February 22nd, 2014, nobody was arguing that he was aggressor. Nobody was arguing that NATO expansion was required for the purposes of containing Russia before February 22nd, 2014. And in fact, when the crisis broke out on February 22nd, 2014, we were actually shocked. If you go back and look at the newspapers at the time, the Obama administration was caught with its pants down. Why? Because they didn't think that the Russians were aggressive. But of course, we had to invent the story after the crisis broke out so that we weren't blamed for what happened. We had to blame the Russians. So we created the story. Second reason you want to doubt this is that Putin has never said that he is bent on recreating the Soviet Union, or he's bent on creating a greater Russia. He's never said he was bent on conquering Ukraine and integrating it into Russia. There's no question that in his heart, he thinks that it would be appropriate for Ukraine to be part of Russia. In his heart, he's made it clear he'd love back to bring back the Soviet Union. But he's also explicitly said that in his head, he fully understands that this is a bad idea. So if you look at what he said, there's no reason to think he's bent on recreating the Soviet Union or creating a greater Russia. To take this a step further, he doesn't have the capability. He doesn't have the capability for two reasons. First of all, he doesn't have a big enough military. This is a country whose gross national product is smaller than Texas's. right? This is not the former Soviet Union in its heyday. Furthermore, the Russians understand that occupying countries or occupying territory in Eastern Europe is a prescription for big trouble. Most of us on this call are old enough to remember the Cold War and all the trouble that the Soviets had. Think East Germany 1953, Hungary 1956, Czechoslovakia 1968, constant trouble with the Poles. And one could argue that the Romanians and the Albanians were the biggest pain in the necks they ever faced. Russians are surely sophisticated enough to know that not only do they not have the capability, but that occupying Ukraine, occupying the Baltic states, would be like swallowing a porcupine. This would be crazy. But anyway, here we are. And I think everybody is very interested in the question of where we go from here. So let me say a few words about that. First of all, let me start with U.S. policy. U.S. policy is to double down. That's what we're going to do. This is what we did after 2014. Instead of reevaluating and saying maybe NATO expansion is not such a good idea, we went in the opposite direction. This is why I'm telling you that by 2021, the Russians understood that we were turning Ukraine into a de facto member of NATO. They understood that. We're encouraging the Ukrainians to resist. We're not going to fight for them, you understand. We're going to fight to the last Ukrainian, but we're not going to do any of the fighting. They're on their own in that regard. But we're going to arm them and do what we can to train them at this late date and hope that they can hang in there and duke it out with the Russians. And nobody believes they're going to defeat the Russians, but maybe you'll get a stalemate. Now, the question you have to ask yourself, this is really the key question, is what are the Russians going to do, right? It seems to me that a lot of people in the West think that if the Ukrainians provide enough resistance, the Russians will roll over and play dead. Or maybe Vladimir Putin will throw his hands up, he'll surrender, he'll say, this was all a bad idea, I regret doing it. Or maybe there'll be a coup in Moscow, he'll be overthrown, and they'll bring in leaders who will work out a deal with us, and Ukraine will live happily ever after, we will live happily ever after, and the Russians will be chastened. I've spent my entire adult life studying great power politics. This is not the way the world works, and it is certainly not the way the Russians work. This is an existential threat, right? So even before the current war, Ukraine and Ukraine becoming part of NATO was viewed as an existential threat. Now you're talking about a situation where you defeat the Russians in Ukraine. This is a much worse outcome for the Russians than what happened in April 2008, and a much worse outcome than what happened in February 2014. And the Russians are not going to roll over and play dead. In fact, what the Russians are going to do is they're going to crush the Ukrainians. They're going to bring out the big guns. They're going to turn places like Kiev and other cities in Ukraine into rubble. They're going to do Fallujahs. They're going to do Mosuls. They're going to do Groznys. You know what happened in World War II when the United States was faced with the possibility of having to invade the Japanese home islands in early 1945. The idea of invading the Japanese home islands after what happened at Iwo Jima and then later what happened in Okinawa really spooked us. So you know what we did? We decided to burn Japanese cities to the ground starting on March 10th, 1945. We killed more people the first night we firebombed Tokyo than we killed at either Hiroshima or Nagasaki. Why? Because we did not want to invade the Japanese main islands. And then there's the nuclear dimension to this. The Russians have already put their nuclear weapons on high alert. This is a really significant development because what they were doing was sending us a very powerful signal as to how seriously they take this crisis and what's going on. So again, if we start winning and the Russians start losing, you want to understand that what we're talking about doing here is backing a nuclear-armed great power that sees what's happening as an existential threat into a corner. This is really dangerous. I think the likelihood of nuclear war is very small, But the likelihood doesn't have to be high for me to be really scared because of the consequences associated with nuclear use. So we better be extremely careful here regarding what we do in terms of pushing the Russians into the corner. But again, I'm not sure that's going to happen, because I think what's going to happen here is that in a competition between us and the Russians will win. Now you're saying to yourself, why is he saying that? I think that if you think about this, you want to think about who has the greater resolve, right? Who really cares more about this situation, the Russians or the Americans? The Americans do not care that much about Ukraine. The Americans have made it clear they are not even willing to fight and die for Ukraine. So it's not that important to us. For the Russians, they have made it clear it's an existential threat. So the balance of resolve, I believe, favors them. So as we walk up the escalation ladder moving forward, my guess, and it's just my guess, is that the Russians will prevail, not the Americans, and the Russians will prevail because the balance of resolve favors them. Now, the question is, who loses this war? I think it doesn't matter much to the United States if we lose in the sense that the Russians prevail in Ukraine. I think the real losers in this war are the Ukrainians. And I think what's happened here is we have led the Ukrainians down the primrose path. We have pushed very hard to encourage the Ukrainians to want to become part of NATO. We have pushed very hard to make them part of NATO. We have pushed very hard to make them a Western bulwark on Russia's borders, despite the fact the Russians made it clear that this was unacceptable to them. We, in effect, and here I'm talking about the West, we took a stick and we poked the bear in the eye. And as you all know, if you take a stick and you poke a bear in the eye, that bear is probably not going to smile and laugh at what you're doing. That bear is probably going to fight back. And that's exactly what's happening here. And that bear is going to tear apart Ukraine. That bear is in the process of tearing apart Ukraine. And again, we go back to where we started. Who bears responsibility for this? Do the Russians bear responsibility for this? I don't think so. There's no question the Russians are doing the dirty work. I don't want to make light of that fact. But the question is, what caused the Russians to do this? And in my opinion, the answer is very simple. The United States of America. Thank you.
That was John Mersheimer, professor of political science at the University of Chicago. He has taught there since 1982. He has a PhD in political science from Cornell University and has written extensively about security issues and international politics. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, TUC Radio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening.